me to come in here and talk about a particularly, well, an issue that's kind of important to us today. So we're going to talk about what we call avoidable crime. These are offenses that are committed by people who our judges have let out of jail on bond or put on probation, or that our correction system lets out on parole. People that really should be in custody and they're not. And we find that it's a very common occurrence for these individuals to commit more crimes. To help me out today, I've got Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Katie Webster.
Hi.
Morning, Katie.
All right. And we're going to talk a little bit about how we deal with these cases in our office. And Detective Joe Holland from the Lexington Police Department.
Joe?
Hello.
Welcome aboard.
And Joe's assigned to what they call the Major Violators Unit. And they deal with a lot of the same people we see. So I'm going to ask him to talk about the police perspective about these sorts of crimes. And then we have a couple of cases that Joe and Katie and I all worked on together that went through the system, and we'll talk about those, time permitting.
All right. Where do we start?
Well, basically, when a case comes to us, it has gone through district court, and then it's gone through the grand jury, and then it goes to circuit court. And there are ways that people can get out of custody. When the police make an arrest, the individual goes to jail. In district court or in circuit court, the judge will set a bond, which is an amount of money that the individual or his friends or family can post with the promise that he'll come back to court. Bond is something that we argue pretty much every time we're in court. The defense attorneys will always ask for a bond reduction. If they don't, their clients will. And the judges a lot of times will reduce bonds, or they'll set what they call a surety bond, which is basically a promise to pay, or a property bond where somebody puts up a car or or some property. And that's one way to get out of custody. We've talked in here a lot about people that get probation. The probation rates for our circuit court run, 50-60%, I think, these days. You stand a pretty good chance of receiving probation. These are ways that people get out of custody. We've talked about it. I've come in here before and talked about the Dirty 30, the property criminals, the Operation Rat Trap, and all that kind of thing. You know, our legislature, we talked about House Bill 463, which curtails our police, the ability of our police to make arrests in certain situations. How they're recommending probation or presumed probation for a lot of offenses. Basically, what it boils down to for us is that in a lot of our cases, people who should be in custody, they should be in jail on bond, or they should be serving prison time, and they're instead on probation, or they've been released on parole. Some of them, you know, go to halfway houses or go to school or do what they're supposed to do. Unfortunately, a lot of these individuals choose to continue their criminal activities, and that's where the Major Violators Unit comes in identifying and tracking these individuals.
All right. So that's where we turn to Joe Holland?
I'm going to ask Detective Holland to talk a little bit about the Major Violators Unit. What makes that different from narcotics or robbery, homicide, or patrol?
Well, we deal with a little bit of everything. Detective Darmody's over specifically shoplifting. We deal with larcenies from auto, which is LFAs. I deal with the pawn shops and work with other jurisdictions when stuff's pawned here, because these guys travel. We have five detectives assigned to our unit, and we get a large majority of the cases that come within the division, because a lot of people break into cars and damage cars because there's really nothing associated jail time-wise with it.
Okay. How do you identify somebody as a major violator? How does an individual like that come to your attention?
They're usually people that commit the crimes over and over. Most of our people that we deal with, you know, they one person may break into 40 or 50 vehicles. Mm-hmm. So, and then when they go to jail, then there are other people that, you know, pick up their slack.
Do you find that a lot of people come into Lexington to either commit these crimes or to sell property that they've stolen in other locations?
Yes, sir.
Why do you suppose that is?
Well, we're the largest city around, so there's more of an opportunity. And we have more pawn shops. There's more drugs here, so they can sell it to people that are acting illegally in that form of enterprise.
What kind of places here in Fayette County do you find that are involved in dealing with this kind of merchandise? When people steal, you know, computers or jewelry, where do they take it here in Fayette County?
Legitimate. The legitimate businesses they take them to are the pawn shops, which is great because the pawn shops work with us. We would probably not find a large quantity of our property if it wasn't for the pawn shops and their partnership with the police department and the county attorney and Commonwealth.
Okay. And does some of this property likewise turn up in, I guess they call them resale shops, places that buy
secondhand
DVDs or books?
Yes,
or clothes,
we have.
Things
of that we have a secondhand ordinance, which I also help oversee, and that covers like kid-to-kid, you know, like those type of places, like half-price books, any place that buys something and gives you monetary value or a gift card in return for that merchandise.
And talk a little bit about gift cards. Is that something that comes into play in a lot of your cases?
A large portion of the cases. A lot of times these individuals will go purchase, well, they'll go shoplift items and take it back to the retailer and say that they lost their receipt. They'll get a gift card for that receipt, and then they'll go pawn that gift card for pennies on the dollar to fund their habits.
But still more pennies than they had when they started.
Correct, yeah. Sir.
Right, and the merchant takes the loss.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm going to talk a little bit more about those, and then we'll talk a little bit about two specific cases that I'd like to bring to your attention.
All right, we'll take a break. Dan Laren is here. That was Detective Joe Holland with him, and we'll get to Katie Webster before we are done with the hour. And if you've got questions or comments, let us know at 253-5959 *590 on AT&T. Toll free 877-777-0590. News Talk 590 WVLK, 20 past 9 Friday morning. Scott Johnson in for Jack Patty on our Forensic Friday, American DA Live. Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Dan Laren is here, as is Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Katie Webster, Detective Joe Holland. We are talking about avoidable crimes. Before we move on, you mentioned something during the break, and I want to ask any of you, or especially Detective Holland, you talk about how you work with the pawn shops, that they're reporting to you guys on a regular basis. We know that you're not dealing with Rhodes Scholars here, but it doesn't take a whole lot of brain power to figure out that just about any place you try to sell the stolen goods is going to tell the cops about it. And yes, I guess technically that was a question.
yes, sir. We have an ordinance that requires that the pawn shops or secondhand stores report to us, the police department, the next business day at 11 a.m. So we get copies. When you go into a pawn shop and a secondhand store, by ordinance, they're supposed to get a copy of your driver's license, pertinent information, and a thumbprint. So we have all that going in.
They do half the work for you.
Yes, sir. Yeah. That is correct.
That's important evidence for us when we get to circuit court. We've had people use little tricks where they don't put their whole thumb down. They try to otherwise conceal the fact that they're selling this stolen property, but it's pretty solid evidence for receiving stolen property charges for us to show that ticket. My experiences with the pawn shops has been pretty positive. They're cooperative and friendly to me when I go out and talk to them. Something that happens a lot of the times is that the thief will try to get someone else to pawn for him. Or her, for that matter. A lot of times they don't have a valid ID, or they're known as felons and they can't be selling firearms, that kind of thing. So they'll get a girlfriend or a friend or a homeless guy who needs a little bit of money and have them commit the crime. So those are things that we track in cases like this, and it's something that's very useful when it comes time to go to court.
Sure.
Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the prosecutor side of these cases. I've talked in some detail about these sorts of cases before. The cases, these come through district court. They come up to us. The rule is basically that $500 or less is a misdemeanor. A lot of times, if the value is an issue, or if the person doesn't have a significant history, those cases are captured at the district court level. We don't see them.
Right.
The county attorney, in my opinion, does a pretty good job of trying to sort those cases out. If there is a particularly egregious case, you know, people that are stealing, you know, military medals or personal heirlooms, wedding rings, large quantities of money, maids that steal out of houses, that kind of thing, it comes up to us. It is a pretty significant number of cases. We review our cases every day, and we get a lot of cases like this. And I'd ask Katie to talk a little bit about how, as prosecutors, we approach these cases and try to get them resolved in a timely fashion. So I guess my first question is, are you, is this the kind of case that you deal with a lot, the shoplifting, the receiving stolen property, the people breaking into cars?
Definitely. A large, significant number of our cases are just kind of theft-related crimes, receiving stolen property kind of crimes, things like that, a large number of those.
Now, what are some of the typical things that the defendants or their attorneys try to tell you to minimize their responsibility for these actions?
Well, a lot of times in receiving stolen property cases where you know somebody's got a class ring, for example, that has someone else's initials engraved on it, pretty obvious to us that that person should have known it was stolen. But what we hear a lot of times is, well, they didn't know it was stolen. Or like Dan mentioned earlier, this person just needed money and somebody else gave that item to him and told him to pawn it. And he didn't know it was stolen. He didn't do anything wrong. We hear that a lot. Part of the problem is that we see a lot of the same people over and over and over, which makes you think, well, they might have known something was going on with that particular item.
Another question, I talked a little bit about this as far as bond conditions. When a case comes through district court, the district court judge will set a bond, and they review the criminal record, the nature of the offense, prior failures to appear, that sort of thing. When it comes up to us, it kind of starts all over again because it's a different judge and there's some different things in play. So what has your experience been as far as attorneys or their clients asking for bond reduction so they can get out of jail as soon as possible?
Well, pretty much every time we go to court, we're arguing a bond motion. And especially in cases like this where it comes up, it's a lower level felony, I guess, as far as that's concerned. But they ask for bond reductions pretty much all the time. And honestly, they get them a lot of times. So it's particularly frustrating for us because someone will come up, it's a repeat offender, somebody who's got a lot of prior felonies or a bad record, they'll get out on bond, and then they'll go back and they'll commit another crime, and then they just come right back to us.
And just keep coming through and keep bonding out.
Exactly.
And we'll talk about one of these particular cases, but how common do you think it is for one defendant to have more than one case, either from the same time or to get out and have it come up at a different time?
It's extremely common. We hear the same names frequently, a lot.
Well, you talk about bonding, and everybody at every level is asking for a bond reduction. You usually, the stories hit the news when there are big murder cases or where there are something really sensational about it, and you hear about a judge setting $1 million cash bond,
right.
You know, and you know, the defendant immediately says, well, I got $1,750 on
right.
me, Judge. Can I go home?
Well, what I can say from my experience, I don't blame the defendant for trying to get out of jail. I mean, I would.
Sure.
Who would?
Yeah.
You don't want to be out there in the jail. But an attorney is supposed to have what they call a good faith basis to file a motion. And you're supposed to have a basis in the facts and a basis in the law and not clog up the courtroom with frivolous motions. And the rules are that when the judge makes a decision, that's the decision unless there's a change in circumstances. And, you know, waiting a week and trying again isn't a legitimate change in circumstances. So it's frustrating for us that we have to just keep dealing with this over and over
right.
and over.
Now, I know that there are different circumstances for different people in different cases.
Sure.
But you've been in here before, Dan, and we have talked about the fact that for some of these people, or for a lot of these people, and Detective Holland, you may be able to add to this as well, this is their career.
Absolutely.
This is their job. And so they come in, this is a part of the cost of doing business, they bond out, and they do what any of us do after we've had a weekend off, they go back to work.
Absolutely. I try to think of it as job security, but it is
for
very,
you.
It is. And for the police as well,
right.
it's very frustrating to the victims in particular because, you know, the lady, we'll talk about her after the news break, you know, the guy broke in, stole her purse, and she says, well, tell me about this guy. And I can share with the victim the public record, which is this man has 3 or 4 prior felonies. He was released by the judge. He was on probation. And, you know, he stole your purse and used your credit card. The victims are very unhappy and angry about that, and I don't blame them either.
And as you're describing that situation, it seems to me that it would be, I don't know, frustrating, confusing. It would almost be easier for me to accept if this was something personal. If they came after me specifically for a reason, but the fact that I'm just somebody random that they hurt because I happened to be on that street that night would drive me nuts.
Well, yeah, I agree. My experience has been the people that deal that I deal with don't know whose car it is. They pick, you know, a gym or the horse park or the arboretum because that's where a lot of cars will be, out at the mall during Christmas. Maybe Detective Holland has some people that are a little different, but that has not been my experience in any of its persons.
Going to get into some specific cases after the break. If you have questions or comments, we'd love to have you join us. 253-5959, star 590 on AT&T. Toll free, 877-777-0590. Email the newsroom, news at WVLKAM.com. I'm Scott Johnson, in for Jack Patty, here on News Talk 590 WVLK. We're talking about avoidable crimes, the things that, crimes that may not have happened had these guys been behind bars where the Commonwealth Attorney's Office says they should have been. And so we've got a couple of specific cases, Dan,
absolutely,
to talk about.
Well, we have the theory. So now we're going to talk about a couple of particular cases. And the first one is a gentleman by the name of Jared Burke. Mr. Burke is a guy that came to us charged with felony theft and some other similar crimes that revolved around gyms and fitness clubs here in Lexington. So Detective Holland was involved in the investigation of this, and I'll ask him to explain how you track Mr. Burke.
Well, we've had an increase in thefts from cars at gyms, local gyms, dog parks, local parks as well. And last summer we had an individual that was going around and doing the similar things. Detective Nate Williams found this individual while he was working out off duty, which led us to this individual, which gave us the car. Well, then we started seeing this same vehicle popping up in all these gyms again. Well, he had just got out of jail, so he started doing what he had normally done. What they would do is they'd go through the gym parking lot, because people, when they go to the gym, don't want to take anything in with them. So they'd sit there, watch people go in, and people would just leave their stuff in their car. And then when they'd go in the gym, they'd get in their car, take their property, and then immediately go, if there was credit cards or whatever, go use the credit cards at the businesses within, you know, a short drive from those locations.
My guess is the irony of this is that people aren't taking their stuff in because they don't think it's going to be safe in the gym while they're working. Is that right?
I would say that is correct,
yeah,
sir.
Okay.
I agree. I've been to a gym in a little while, but when I used to go to the YMCA, I don't know why. I guess I felt my property was safer in my car than it was when I put it in a locker inside the facility. And as I have learned through experience, I don't think that's necessarily
true. That ain't the case,
true.
Yeah. All right.
So, well, in this case, I guess your first lead was the vehicle, and then
yes, sir.
You tracked that.
Yes, sir.
Would it be fair to say that Mr. Burke is somebody that the Major Violators Unit was aware of?
We were aware of the vehicle. At that point in time, I had not heard of Mr. Burke.
Oh, okay.
We were aware of the SUV that they were in from our previous dealings with the owner of that SUV and the numerous cars that he had broken into a few months prior to that.
Okay. What focused your attention on Mr. Burke?
Well, we started getting video of the credit cards being used, and I believe it was Detective Newman that recognized him, and okay. We went from there.
All right. Well, Mr. Burke, this was a case that was assigned to me.
Mm-hmm.
Our cases, we all kind of specialize in different areas, but we get kind of a batting order. It's just we get 15, and then the next prosecutor gets 15, and it could be anything. Mr. Burke came up to me, and so I talked to Detective Holland and some of the other members of the Major Violators Unit regarding his charges. And he was charged with felony theft. And in this particular case, the victim had parked at the YMCA. And we tracked him by his credit card. He had another case where he stole a laptop, some credit cards, and some other items about a month later. And at that point, the detectives caught up to him, arrested him, and brought him in. So he was a persistent felony offender because of his criminal history, which I'll talk about in a minute, and charged with these felony thefts. I talked to the victims in this case prior to grand jury. The lady that parked a car at the YMCA was very upset. She had a purse that had some It was in December, so she has some Christmas money, some personal items that were stolen that she never saw again. The gentleman who had the backpack with the laptop in it was a UK student, and he was pretty upset because he had items, school items, and personal information, his social security number, his identity, right. You know, tax returns, things like that on his laptop. And I don't believe that Mr. Burke was committing the crime for that kind of information, but he steals the computer and he pawns it or sells it or he trades it for drugs. That information could go anywhere, and that's something that this particular victim was very unhappy about, and that makes all of us a little nervous. So we looked at this case. He's charged as a persistent felony offender. He has two current offenses. His attorneys asked for what we call a package deal or a rapid disposition. Now, the theory there is that if he's got two crimes, we'll give him a slight break on the second crime in return for him resolving two cases.
You know, it's like retail.
Yeah, it is, kind of. It's, you know, it's a negotiation like a lot of other things. Yeah. It's hard for us to do that. You know, it's a guy that shouldn't be out anyway,
mm-hmm.
and he commits a new offense, and, you know, we're kind of hard-pressed to be particularly nice to him. In this particular case, he agreed to plead to the persistent felony offender charge on one of his cases, and we didn't use the persistent felony offender enhancement on his other charge. We could have. The defense attorney's argument in that case would be, you know, 20 years is kind of steep for stealing a purse out of a car. I guess I can understand that, and our judges might understand that. Our position was this particular individual, his priors are 5 counts of burglary and a count of, and theft by unlawful taking in 2011. He got 4 years, was put on probation in 2011. He also had a prior felony conviction for non-support, misdemeanor DUIs and AIs. So
this wasn't just stealing a purse.
Right, yeah. Right. And that's our argument, is that you build up the persistent felony offender. You don't just walk in and get 10 years for a theft.
Right.
He's we consider his record as well. He got put on probation. He was on active probation. He had 2 sanctions where he violated the terms of his probation, and they let him back out. And that's the judge's decision that puts him on probation. You know, when I was in high school, there was a policy that if you missed 3 days or less, you didn't have to take the final. And that the policy was keep you in school. What we saw it as was 2 free days to skip.
Exactly, class. Yes.
And so,
and that's, you know, human nature, though.
Right.
You're gonna press that as far as you can.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah.
And so this guy, you know, he knows that he gets put on probation, and if he commits a little crime or smokes a little weed, it's no big deal. Well, it's a big deal to us. It's a big deal to the victims. This guy should have been in the county jail or the penitentiary, and he wasn't, and he's on active probation. He commits these 2 felony offenses. So we resolved it by 5 years on one charge, a year on the other charge, and we wrote a memo to the judge, and we asked the judge specifically to put him in prison. And in this case, and I'll be honest with you, I got to give the judge credit. I didn't think the judge was going to do it because it's a low-level property crime. The victims were very upset. She submitted a victim impact statement. And I made my little argument there, and the judge sent him to prison. So Mr. Burke is currently at the assessment center, which is where you go before corrections sends you out. He is eligible for parole next year, so we'll keep him off the street and out of the cars of the people in our community
for
until August
of
2016. Hopefully they'll keep him in, but we'll fight that battle when we have to.
That's Assistant Commonwealth's Attorney Dan Laren. We've also got Katie Webster and Joe Holland with us, and we got one more segment. If you've got questions or comments, love to hear from you at 253 News Talk 590 WVLK. Coming into our last segment of Forensic Friday's American DA Live, but let me remind you to go get signed up for some free food from Sarah's Barbecue at Liberty and Henry Clay. Every Friday, we draw somebody to win lunch for up to 10 people. We call it Free Food Friday. Get to WVLKAM.com. And you could win. Sign up today for Free Food Friday from Sarah's Barbecue and News Talk 590 WVLK. Last segment, Assistant Commonwealth's Attorneys Dan Laren and Katie Webster, Detective Joe Holland, Lexington Police. Before we wrap up and cover this last case, is there a way you can generalize what persistent felony offender adds to someone's sentence?
Sure. A persistent felony offender is someone who has 1 or 2 previous felony convictions. Generally, if they're a second-degree PFO is what we call it, it bumps their penalty up 1. If they're a first degree, it bumps it up 2. So a Class D felony, that's 1 to 5 years. A PFO second would be looking at 5 to 10. PFO first would be looking at 10 to 20. Additionally, if you're a persistent felony offender, there are some restrictions on probation. So if you are guilty of a Class C felony and a persistent felony offender in the first degree, you're not eligible for probation. That's kind of the holy grail for us in property crimes. That's when somebody's going to serve some time. It takes a while to get somebody there. That's a very brief summary.
We got about 3 minutes here. Okay. Is there any difference as you're talking about, you know, the crimes committed by the people who you want to be behind bars, but they're out on the street? Is there any difference between the guys who have bonded out and are waiting for trial and the guys who've actually served their time and are back out then? Is there any difference in behavior? Do they learn anything while they're in there except how to be better criminals?
I don't think so.
Okay. Everybody's nodding their heads. Yeah, that's what they want.
Most of the people we've got, I'll just briefly summarize this last case. This guy's name is Jared Michael. He likewise targeted people that were parking in different areas of our community, apartment complexes, stole a bunch of things. He had a very extensive criminal history. He had probation violations. He was on parole when he did all this sort of thing. And it brings me back to, you remember Animal House when they were on double secret probation?
You bet.
It's kind of like that, you know? When they release the guy and he keeps committing crimes, and then they release him again and put him on double secret probation. Yeah. You know, Michael he's 30 years old. He's very unlikely to do anything else at this point. I hope he does. I hope he learns how to be a plumber or a roofer or a farmer or something while he's in corrections. And when he gets out, he stops breaking into people's cars and houses. Odds are not good. So that's kind of my answer to that. I could, the judges, I'll give them credit where it's due. They generally probate a lot of people, but in these cases and in a lot of our other cases, when someone's given the privilege of bond or probation, our judges have shown a tendency to respond by putting these people in custody rather than letting them back out all the time. That's what happened in these two cases, which was good news for us. The victims were very happy. And I can hold my head up when I go back to the police department and ask them to do things like come to the radio station and talk about cases. Because I feel like I'm helping them and helping their cases resolve in a way that they should.
For any of you, in our last minute or so, you guys, you know who these guys are or who many of them are, but we can't see them coming. Is there any way we can protect ourselves from them?
Well, I would I tell everybody to make sure that, you know, you don't leave anything of value in plain view. If you're going to go to the gym, I would put it in my trunk because it at least makes it harder for them to get into. If you just leave it in plain view, I mean, it's simple to break a window. It's a lot harder to get into the trunk. Don't leave anything of value in your car. Make sure you lock your car. And you'd be surprised at how many firearms that are left in cars unsecured. Know the serial numbers to your personal property that's of value. That way, when the police come and take a report, if you do happen to become a victim, it increases the likelihood of us being able to find the property.
All right. Detective Joe Holland, Katie Webster, Dan Laren, thanks for being here.
Thank you very much. We'll see you next time around.
Yeah, I'm here next week. Are you?
Don't know yet.
You don't know yet. All right, well, we'll find out. We'll let you